Tango Tango Papa 1794, November 11, 2013.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Excuse me, Tom Wiles here coming to you this evening from Cuba, Missouri. So I drove about 515 miles today and still have, I don't know, let me put my glasses on. I don't have my contact lenses in. Let me see if I can see the GPS. It says 1866. So I have 1,866 more miles to go to make it to Fresno, California. So I should be able to make it. I'll have to use about 4 hours of that I have that I'll be getting after midnight Thursday. So I'll have to time it. So that I get there, I'll try to time it so that I get there about an hour before the appointment. The appointment is at 7 a.m. Pacific time on Thursday. They don't have any overnight parking or anything, so I'll just have to time it so that I get there not too long before the appointment. And then once I pick the load up, then I'll have to go to a truck stop. Now that shouldn't be any problem. I'm trying. California's got plenty of truck stops in most cases, especially in the San Joaquin Valley, where Fresno's located. So I shouldn't have too much trouble getting to a truck stop if I, you know. And then it depends. I'll have a few hours left. I'll have to kind of look at my hour situation and sort of figure out where I'm at with hours once I'm there. So, but should be able to make it you know, just by sort of shifting things around and particularly stopping so that I can start sometime after midnight on Thursday, so that I'll, you know, and I'll be about roughly, let's say, 4 to 5 hours from Fresno, from wherever I stop at, you know, kind of depending. So, should be able to make that work. But that's, you know, you have these rules and what have you, and particularly with the electronic logs, but they did it before. They would audit the logbook against the Qualcomm truck position history. So with the electronic logs, it just kind of nails things down, and the rules are the rules, and everybody in the company has to live by them. And sometimes they can be a little bit onerous, but on the other hand, they do sort of prevent, in many cases, they prevent you from doing something you really shouldn't. And yeah, and then on the other hand, running completely up against them, that's really kind of a little bit harder than I care to work. So, but anyway, so I've made it here to Cuba, Missouri, and it was not a bad day today. The sun was out all day. It was I think it got up to about 55 degrees, at least where I was at. I spent the night there last night in at Ashland, Kentucky. And so weather's pretty decent. So far, so good. In the last podcast, I played Michael Moss's audio comment, you know, and he's talking about the generic use, quote unquote, generic use of the so-called N-word, you know, particularly, you know, sports teams, these players are sort of calling each other, and the black musicians, black media people, people that are sort of popular, some of them are calling each other the N-word. You know, and so it's kind of common, at least in that kind of culture. Now, I don't know, just in the black culture itself, I don't know if the average person is doing that. And I've had time to think about that more. And the so-called black culture has nothing at all to do really with skin color. They claim that it does, but it does not. It's more about language. Culture usually revolves around language. And you can see a really clear example. You look at French Canada versus English speaking Canada. And, at one point, the province of Quebec, dates back a number of years, they were getting to the point where they were getting serious about seceding from Canada, so that they could have their own French-speaking Quebec. Somehow being part of English-speaking Canada was somehow contaminating their beautiful culture. And that's a clear example of culture sort of revolving around language, or how it can revolve around language. Now, in the case of the black people in America, their ancestors were slaves, and obviously they resented that, and their ancestors resented it. But then the thing with resentment, you think that resentment is a good thing, and you can turn it into a positive thing. And of course the thing with resentment is that you believe that it seems like it's some sort of a protection. If you resent somebody, it's like you're in your mind you're sort of wishing them dead, as if you could strike them dead with your thoughts, as if you were God. Of course you're not, and you can't. And so when you resent, you become what you hate. You become more of what you hate, what you resent. You turn into what you resent. And you'll either turn into it overtly, or you'll try to rebel and do what you perceive to be the opposite. But either way, you are separated from your who you could have been originally. A ground of being is a good phrase. It separates you from the ground of being that you should see. Because when we come into this world, Adam, going back to the Adam and Eve story, whenever Adam came into the world, God created Adam. However he did it, created Adam and Eve. He created Adam. Adam had and Eve both had a sort of a perfect ground of being, and everything was in perfect order. And so Adam had this perfect ground of being, but the temptation was, and he had to be put to the test, because what good would it be if he was just enslaved to that perfect ground of being? That would be akin to, you build the doll and pull the little string and it says, I love you, I love you, I love you. Well, what good is that? Who wants a wind-up robot that says, I love you? Nobody does. So, Adam had to be put to the test. And, of course, he failed. And I think God knew that he would fail. But he failed, and so once he failed, once Adam and Eve fell, then they ended up having offspring, and then you have the whole idea of us being born in sin, and so on and so forth. But Adam had this ground of being, and he was tempted away from it. And it turned into an enemy. You know, once you're tempted away, from that ground of being, it turns into an enemy. It turns into a guilty conscience. You want to run away from it. Of course, if you just allow it to catch up with you, it may not feel too pleasant for a bit. But if you simply allow that to catch up with you, then you feel the guilt, and then you get through it, and that's the end of it. But if you drive a wedge, you try to run away from it, it just makes it bigger, and you have a bigger problem. You have an ever more guilty conscience that you're trying to escape from. And it will drive you to the point where you know people will do all kinds of crazy things to try to escape that, you know. And then they'll run into the arms of other people, and you have this ground of being. So that, in a sense, you know, in a very real sense, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about, what is your ground of being? Where does that ground of being come from? Now, you have the choice. It's either for us, because we're born sort of separate from that, separated from it. We have the choice of being saved by that ground of being. If you simply do nothing and allow it to catch up with you, don't try to roll your sleeves up and fix yourself, because you can't. If you allow that to catch up with you, then it will sort of re-bond with you, and problem solved. You know, that's what salvation is about. But otherwise, you are enslaved to the world, and the world sort of ground of being. And so then you have all of the groupthink. And groupthink, if you think about it, and you could substitute, instead of saying groupthink, which the groupthink, I think everybody kind of understands what groupthink is, or at least I hope they do, but you could substitute the term tribethink. You could substitute the term tribethink. So anytime you think of, if there's groupthink, it's also tribethink. And so what ends up happening if you have these different, you could think of it this way, if you have these different tribes, and so you have a labor union tribe with a tribal, with a tribal leader. And of course, leaders, the scum always kind of rises to the top, and people have a tendency, guilty people have a tendency to elect people that are worse than they are. Make those people that are worse than they are into their leaders. And that holds true for many different types of organizations, including, and certainly not limited to, but including government. But all kinds of organizations, the scum tends to rise to the top if it's a tribal, sort of out of tribe think. So you have the labor union tribe, and you have the black American tribe, and you have you can have all kinds of different tribes. Now, in the last podcast, I was trying to, with this idea of the N-word, they're able to use the N-word. The black people, they can call each other the N-word all day long, and, no big deal, apparently. But if a white person dares utter that, all hell breaks loose. Same way with the Q-word when it comes to homosexuals. They can call each other all kinds of names and so on and so forth. But if the wrong, someone that's not part of the tribe uses that Q word, all hell breaks loose. So I was trying to think of, you know, what other types of situations would that apply to? And so this would probably revolve really more around things that people are, as opposed to what they, you know, what they're choosing to do, what they sort of are, as a based, you know, kind of based on resentment. You know, and the black people, this so-called black culture, is based on resentment, and of course the parents put it into their children. They pass it on to their children. The children are sort of stuck with it. Bible says sins of the fathers are passed on to the third and fourth generations, and that's in part what it's talking about. You know, if you resent as a parent, and I'm not a parent, never haven't been, not a parent. Have no intention of becoming a parent, never will be a parent. However, you know, just to put that little qualifier out there, just in case somebody's going to tell, you know, try to accuse me of, you know, giving advice and I'm not a parent, how dare I speak? Well, I'm just qualifying and I'm disarming myself right up front. I'm not a parent. But, so if you're a parent and you resent, you're pushing the consequences, you're pushing that resentment off onto your kids, whether you like it or not, doesn't matter, because you're a slave. And you'll make your kids into slaves. And so the black people have been, you know, even though they're free in a legal sense, they're enslaved to this sort of tribe think, this black tribe think. And you know, once in a while you have one that doesn't go along with it, and of course then they become a big object of ridicule. You know, Clarence Thomas, I can name you a bunch of them. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, look at what they've tried to do to him, because he dared to not be part of the tribe think. But, you know, in the case of black people, you know, they do tie it to skin color, because then it becomes very easy for them to identify each other. You know, now in the case of homosexuals, they're pretty good. I think they're pretty good at sort of identifying each other, mostly. You know, and if you know what to look for, there are certain characteristics you can kind of pretty well come close to figuring it out a lot of times. But, you know, it's something that they are, as a, you know, whatever the reason that they're homosexual, you know, and we won't even get into that, but whatever that reason is, there is resentment involved. And certainly there's resentment involved because for whatever reason they're guilty people, and you know, society sort of won't accept them, and they sort of feel that society, the reason they feel guilty is because society won't accept them, and so therefore, you know, pass laws to try to force people to accept them, force people to love them. And you know, the proper way to look at it, I don't care what somebody does, don't really care one way or the other, just, you know, whether, you know, as when it comes to sexuality, keep it to yourself, and I don't care if it's, you know, if you're heterosexual, homosexual, whatever, I don't want to hear about your sex, I don't want to hear about, you know, and there are plenty of heterosexual people that do the same thing, you know, especially heterosexual men sometimes will just really go on and on and on, and they're crude and rude and vulgar about it. I don't want to hear about it. So, but they are, you know, it's an identity that is revolves, they have this identity that for whatever reason it revolves around resentment, and of course they begin to resent even more because people, they feel like people aren't accepting them or whatever, begin, and other, you know, there's other reasons as well, but they resent, and you know, it's something that they can't change. They're enslaved in the same way, you know, to a sort of a tribe think. So there's a sort of a homosexual tribe think. In the same way, there's a sort of a homosexual, or I'm sorry, a black think. You know, sort of a black tribe think. So I was thinking, you know, I was wondering, well, you know, labor unions are, you know, it's kind of like a, you know, you resent going to work and you agitated and the man's screwing you and your boss is screwing you and he's exploiting you to get rich and what have you. So they get all upset about that. Now, that is not really something that is based on what you are or how you look or how, you know, your body language. That is more of a, so the idea that you know, labor union people are calling themselves names, but you can't call them names from the outside. That doesn't really apply. But I was thinking, well, what other cases would there be where it's based on what somebody, you know, their physical body structure or something, some trait, some physical trait that they can't change. And then, you know, of course, what comes to mind would be, you know, and I'm going to use the M word, midget, you know, someone that, and that's sort of a slang term for someone that, you know, that has stunted growth. And there's different, I don't know what I guess I should look up the formal term for that, but, you know, they could probably, I could see where they could call each other that if they wanted to. But if you said that word, if you called them that, otherwise, I could see where they would go ballistic. But coming back to the N-word, that and the Q-word, those are terms of ridicule. Those are terms of belittlement. And those are terms of degradation. And so they are abhorrent, and that's why, you know, I won't use those words. Because they are degrading terms. And so, in a sense, they're sort of, in a very real sense, the black people are, you know, when they're, you know, these ball players and what have you, in a very real sense, they're sort of degrading each other by calling each other by that name. You know, and they're saying, well, it's a generic use of it. Well, that's ridiculous. Let's just be honest. They're degrading each other. It would be a method of, you know, and they're enslaved to doing it, but it would be sort of a method of, you know, they're sort of keeping each other in check. And it's a sort of an identity. Whether they like it or not, it doesn't matter. But it's a kind of it's a perverted sort of an externalized identity that happens because of this tribe think, this group think. And there's all kinds of different group think. It's not limited to black people. It's not limited to homosexuals. There's all kinds of tribe think that sort of goes on. You know, and a lot of it, sometimes it can be based on physical characteristics, ethnicity, you know, let's say a fat person, you know, they might call each other fat, but if you call them fat, you know, I can see where some of them would go ballistic. You know, you're hurting my feelings kind of thing. So in the case, you know, just to kind of wrap this discussion up, I think it really revolves, you know, in particular with the black people and these, you know, these ball players and what have you. They're just, they're degrading each other when they use that term, whether they're trying to put in somebody's, you know, it's probably some sports announcer's probably trying to put a nice spin on it. But they're degrading each other. They're just trying to dress it up. But it's they're really degrading each other when they call each other that. They're degrading each other, and that's really what's going on. So thank you, Michael, for asking that question, because it did cause me to sort of think about it further, and that's really what's going on. They're degrading each other with that. So, you know, it's, I don't know, it's, people will really, you know, all of these things, are based on principles, and the principles themselves are pretty, simple, but they end up, you know, in a jillion different variations. But the principles are always the same. The principles are always very simple. So I also have some more water documentaries, and then I've got another one that I'm going to play the audio for. And then I got this other one that's kind of a longer one. It's 29 minutes and 23 seconds. It's about plants. A number of years ago, there was this this guy that was experimenting with plants, and he was putting, you know, hooking human being lie detectors up to plants, and then he was threatening the plants and burning their leaves and so on and so forth, and getting electrical reactions out of the plants. And I always, you know, they never said that was really science, but nonetheless, it's very interesting. it's just one of those really interesting things. And I don't know that they've, you know, I'm sure people are sort of pursuing that now, but it's sort of an area, it's just an interesting area of sort of pseudoscience, and you don't really know. But it, now, on the other hand, anecdotally, there are people, you hear the term that people have green thumbs, and some people just don't grow things very well, and then there are other people that they plant something, and they have all kinds of plants, and the plants grow really well for them, and, you know, for whatever reason. And so there, you know, anecdotally, there is that, you know, sort of the green thumb, and I think there it's possible that there's something to that. Now, these people could just be very intuitive about knowing how much to water the plant and so on, and they're very knowledgeable about it. But on the other hand, there could well be something to it. You know, this universe that we live in, we have this idea. We like to think we're very knowledgeable and that we know all there is to know, and of course we don't. We only, you know, I suspect we only know maybe 0.5% of everything there is to know about this physical universe we find ourselves in, this physical existence. We really don't know. It's just, you know, I always like watching all these different science programs and what have you, Discovery Channel stuff and documentaries and what have you, about, the universe and new discoveries. And I listen to a lot of, podcasts where they're talking about new discoveries and so on and so forth. And they're all, you know, the results are always surprising and shocking. And why would that be? Why would they be so shocking? It's because we think we know. We think we have everything pegged. It's kind of like you watch hours and hours of CNN and Fox and MSNBC and CNBC. You watch hours and hours of that stuff, and you have this idea that you're really knowledgeable. You really know what's going on today. You watched all these hours, and they kept repeating this stuff over and over. that, you know, they left things out. Well, same thing is true. You think you know all about science and everything's nailed down. Well, oh no, it isn't. So, in any case, so I'm going to go ahead and play, before this drags on too long, I'm going to go ahead and play this first one. It's about plants, and as I say, it's about 29 minutes and 23 seconds, so here we go.
Welcome to the Baxter School of Lie Detection. I'm Cleve Baxter, and during the next 6 weeks here in San Diego, you're going to be involved in a very intensified instructional course in the use of the polygraph, or so-called lie detector.
In the course of a career dedicated to investigation for federal and municipal law enforcement agencies, Cleve Baxter has earned a reputation as the world's foremost authority on the polygraph.
Well, as of February 2nd, 1966, I'd been in the polygraph field full-time for 18 years. And this particular morning, I had been working all night in the laboratory and had decided to water a plant in the lab, very similar to the plant here, Dracaena cane plant. My thought was that as the moisture arrived to the leaf of the plant, the plant should be a better conductor, and I should get a reading on the chart. Well, strangely enough, I didn't get this at all, and in fact, it did just the opposite. Instead of the tracing edging upward as it should have on the chart, it went into sort of a wild excitation, very similar to the first part of a human taking a polygraph test. But then it occurred to me, just about 14 minutes along, what would be the real optimum threat to the well-being of a plant. In fact, the imagery of fire entered my mind, and I not only thought, but I fully intended to burn the very leaf that was being tested with a match. Now, I had no matches in the room at the time, and I don't smoke, and I had to go next door to my secretary's area to get a match. But the interesting thing is that right at the split second that imagery of fire entered my mind, the tracing reflecting the changes in the plant just went right off the top of the page. And the only thing that occurred at that time, no lighting of a match, nothing else, merely the imagery of fire. And I must say that as of 14 minutes along in that initial observation on the morning of February 2nd, 1966, my life just hasn't been the same.
Responding to the initial experience, when a plant apparently read his mind, Baxter works nights on his own in his small laboratory. His goal is to perfect an experiment that will satisfy the rigid criteria of the scientific establishment. Baxter hopes to show that plants react to any termination of life in their immediate environment. During the next 6 hours, at some undetermined moment chosen by a randomizer, these brine shrimp will fall to their deaths in boiling water. By totally automating his equipment, Baxter is determined to eliminate human influence. In another room, completely separate from his laboratory, Baxter has placed a philodendron plant, a polygraph, and a videotape recorder. Carefully, he places a leaf between a pair of electrodes that will monitor the electrical activity of the plant. As he has done during countless police interrogations, Baxter establishes a baseline on his polygraph to get an accurate recording of the reaction of his subjects. The video recorder will tape the details of the experiment in Baxter's absence.
For the automation of this experiment to be successful, I have to get a certain distance away from my lab so that my consciousness won't affect the results.
California Dawn often finds Cleve Baxter still at work in a small room behind his laboratory. The results of each night's work must be carefully analyzed and recorded. In spite of his high percentage of successful results, only a few daring individuals from the scientific establishment have come forward with offers to replicate his experiments or test his results. The great majority are content simply to condemn his efforts without taking the trouble to investigate their validity.
A few brine shrimp die and the plant feels their death. I think it's the smallness of the event that makes it so significant. It means that even on the lower levels of life, there's a profound consciousness or an awareness that binds all things together.
Research conducted in the Soviet Union leads scientists to believe that plants may think. Attached to delicate electronic instruments, a cabbage plant registers annoyance to the exhaling of tobacco smoke on its leaf surfaces. A scene familiar in any kitchen takes on special importance in this experiment.
Володя, переключи задание по всем параметрам. Тамара, бери препарат. Все готовы? Начинай.
In some mysterious way, the plant which is attached to the instrument is able to feel the mutilation of its comrade. In a more advanced experiment, technicians were asked to pass through a laboratory containing two living cabbage plants. One of the subjects has been instructed to destroy the plant which is not attached to the electronic instruments. Later, the technicians are asked to return to the scene of the crime. The evidence is clear. The remaining plant has correctly identified the assailant.
Ты должна быть сердитой.
Years, gardening enthusiasts throughout Japan have been privileged to witness the remarkable demonstrations of Dr. and Mrs. Kenneth Hashimoto. Dr. Hashimoto, managing director and chief of research for the Fuji Electronic Industries, has constructed special instruments which translate the electrical output of plants into modulated sounds, giving voice to a cactus. Relying on her affinity for plants, Mrs. Hashimoto looks forward to actual conversation with her cactus. Convinced that it possesses an intelligence, she is determined to teach it the Japanese alphabet.
Oh,
Norman Goldstein, a professor of biology and expert in the new science of electrophysiology, agrees to review the results of the experiment, which will determine whether the plant Mimosa pudica actually responds to human emotions.
As you can see, we have a normal, you know, copper screen and such as that Faraday cage, block out electromagnetic signals, radiations. But in addition to that, we have a plexiglass over here that blocks the wind movements and ion movements and air flows that would, you know, shake the plant, cause abnormal signals. We also have a motion detector in here, which will allow us to look and see whether any external motions or movements have interfered with the experiment, so we can tell when the plant has actually vibrated.
Where's the subject with respect to the cage now?
We're going to seat him within a few feet of the cage, probably about 5 feet, and he'll be viewing a screen. He'll be watching a stimulus movie that we're providing, and then his emotional responses should carry over into the cage here and affect the plant. That's what we're hoping for.
We're going to be measuring your galvanic skin response, which means your emotional activity.
Okay. Let's hope there is some.
Is that too tight?
No, that's great.
Okay. This is going to measure your blood volume. And this will measure the muscle tension in your forehead, or the EMG.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Good.
Individual's response is producing some kind of energy display. When you're finished analyzing your data and it supports your contentions, you can imagine what importance this would be. You can imagine it'll change our whole picture of how we relate to plants, that we're interacting with them all the time.
For 6 years, L. George Lawrence, a Silesian-born electronics engineer, has used an abandoned prospector's cave in the California desert as a base of operations for research in a new science called biocommunications. His purpose in choosing such a remote location was to eliminate man-made electronic interference during a series of remarkable experiments.
I started my Voigon plans in 1962 while I was an engineer in the aerospace industry. And at that time, it was one of our goals to develop jam-proof missile components. Now, after much experimentation, my attention turned to living plant material, in particular to plant leaves. Plant leaves are able to react to gravitational changes, to temperature changes, to electrostatic fields, and so on, simultaneously. Now, a man-made sensing device cannot do this. So, as time went on, and I experimented with these various plants and plant leaves, I noted very unusual reaction patterns. Now, at that time, I thought that my equipment was defective. It did not occur to me that I was witnessing a profound consciousness in these living plants. But I was an engineer, a nuts and bolts man. I needed to perfect a machine-based system just for the specific purpose of finding out the truth about consciousness in plants. And to my extreme surprise, it worked. There is indeed a consciousness in the plant kingdom.
Lawrence's latest equipment differs significantly from that of other researchers. It dispenses with the necessity to use electrodes directly attached to the subject. He has found through experiments that living vegetable tissue perceives signals with greater sensitivity than electronic sensors. These tiny mustard seeds, removed from a nutrient bath at the point of germination, will act as antennae to receive distant biological radiation. Emerging into the desert night, Lawrence prepares his equipment. At the end of a Faraday tube, he inserts the seeds which will monitor the signals. A rotating beam splitter will eliminate radio interference. Consulting a star map, Lawrence searches for the constellation Ursa Major, the Great Bear. It is to celestial coordinates 10 hours, 40 minutes, by 56 degrees, that he will direct his instrument. Lawrence scans the heavens, waiting for the seeds to receive a distant signal. After analysis of his experiment by the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C., L. George Lawrence believes the living plant tissue in his instrument is receiving a message from outer space.
Plants communicate with each other. It would also appear in our case that we have actually eavesdropped on a communication that has gone on for millions and millions of years. And by some freak accident, by simply allowing a sensing instrument to remain pointed at the sky, we were able to intercept what seems to be a universal truth.
When you first say water to people, they think, oh, you know, it's just, you know, the stuff I drink every day and I bathe in it. I mean, what could be so special? Let's take, for example, an experiment that was done And this is where I get really excited, because it also relates to the search for communication with other star systems.
Okay.
You see in this experiment done, and this is in Water the Great Mystery, where they take a pitcher of water, and they separate the pitcher of water into two pitchers of water, and they separate both pitchers at a great distance. And when you expose information to one pitcher of water, the other at a distance restructures itself according to that information instantly, using atomic clocks.
That's incredible.
Instantly. And what amazes me about that is, over and over and over again, no matter how far you go back, and going back, actually, there's a Russian scientist named Alexander Zhijevsky, whom in the 1930s noticed that bacteria in water would constantly become agitated during the exact moment of solar flares. And he noticed this over and over and over again. Whenever there was a solar flare, the activation of the bacteria going crazy happened before the solar radiation hit the Earth. In fact, it takes 8.3 minutes for sun solar radiation to travel from the sun's 93 million miles from Earth to get here.
That's right.
So the bacteria knew it instantly. Why? Why did the bacteria in the water know? Well, the interesting thing is, our sun is 93% hydrogen, and there's oxygen in the sun. And that means that these two bodies of water at a distance are actually talking to each other instantaneously. And the bacteria in the water gets activated because the water is receiving this information. Now, when we consider the vast distances, for example, the distance between our Milky Way galaxy and the Andromeda galaxy, which is 2.2 million light years away, if you were communicating using radio waves with Andromeda, if we could, it would take over 2.2 million years to get there. But yet, the hydrogen in the stars in the Andromeda galaxy, and the hydrogen in our stars, and the spiraling arms of the Milky Way galaxy, and the water in our own bodies can communicate instantaneously over the...
See, you're onto something, David.
You see, there's something going on here. Now, what does it mean if scientists can prove that this little element that is virtually existent everywhere in the universe can communicate with different bodies of distant hydrogen instantaneously, and that it has consciousness, and that the consciousness of water is kind of like Professor Rustam Roy at Penn State calls an alphabet. You can give it new words and new sentences, and therefore it structures itself differently according to the information you give it. And now, when you kind of add all the pieces together, and you realize that no super intelligent civilization would be broadcasting anything in the radio spectrum because it travels at the speed of light and it's much too slow, and you're starting to see this evidence of action at a distance through hydrogen aqueous systems like the sun and bodies of water and telepathy, the evidence is overwhelming.
Something about these people who actually know the truth. The rest of us here, we're sitting around in cyberspace and on the internet speculating about whether any of this stuff is real,
yeah.
And yet here you have people that are walking up to a crashed disk and looking into the eyes of a wounded or dying alien. I mean, you can't even imagine what that's actually like if you're actually there. There's no more doubt in your mind at that point that we're not alone in the cosmos. And in the course of Sergeant Clifford Stone's work, he was given briefing documents which gave very precise descriptions of all 57 varieties of ET, so that if he came up to a crashed extraterrestrial wreckage, that he would know who he was dealing with when he got there and what kind of characteristics they had.
When I got out in 1989, we had cataloged 57 different species. You have individuals that look very much like you and myself that could walk among us and you wouldn't even notice the difference, except for some of the things that they might be able to go ahead, even in a dark room, and touch an object and go ahead and identify what color that object might be. They would have a heightened sense of smell, sight, hearing. Situation is that you have various types of what we normally call grays. We didn't call them grays in the military, but you had at least three types of the grays. You had some that were much taller than we were. The unique thing that I'd like to point out for the most part is that the entities that we did catalog were in fact humanoid, and that creates a question that yet has to be answered by science.
It seems that this particular galaxy has designed human beings exclusively to evolve within it. And to get back to your original question, yes, most of these people have essentially a very similar set of beliefs. The idea that the fundamental energy that makes all matter as we know it is conscious and has an awareness that is essentially unified.
Since 1959, the Academy of Sciences of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics has advanced research for the application of automation and cybernetics in plant husbandry. Connected to electronic instrumentation, these plants express their wishes directly, without the need of human guidance. In agricultural centers of the future, plants will show themselves to be fully rational beings, controlling their intake of water and nutrients, and even regulating the temperature and humidity of their environment. We're just beginning to understand the language of plants. It is a difficult and fascinating road wherein a multitude of surprises awaits us.
Okay, so there was the audio for, it was a documentary, and you can find it on YouTube. It's about plants, Clive Baxter. Very interesting. Don't know. You know, I'm sure that people have, I need to search YouTube and find out if, because, you know, if people have tried to duplicate this, I'm sure they have. But it's pretty interesting stuff. Okay, so the next thing I want to play, I've got this documentary, another documentary, little short thing about water. It's 10 minutes and 30 seconds long. And so I'm going to go ahead and play that. So here we go.
Water. Water, the most common substance on Earth. It is with us every moment of our lives. But do we know the secrets of this amazing element? Where did it come from? Who bestowed water on our planet, and why? The only such planet in the universe. Perhaps only water itself knows the answers to these questions. There is just as much water on Earth today as there was when everything began. When the world was born, and acquired the shape and sensations we know so well.
So what we did was what we always do here, do very careful work in a narrow field. So we said, let us focus on water, but we will look at it from many angles.
In the Holy Scripture, water is more than simply a physical substance. It's a certain concept, and that concept is connected in a special way with the idea of life. Nothing in the world is softer and more yielding than water. Yet it wears down the hard and the strong, and none can overcome it, though anyone can conquer it. That which is yielding conquers the strong, and the soft overcomes that which is hard. Everyone knows this, but no one dares to live by it. The Chinese philosopher Lao Tzu wrote about water 2,500 years ago.
I mean, water as such has been extensively studied. I mean, it is well known that water has unusual properties, physico-chemical properties, when compared to other liquids.
No scientist has been able to explain, for example, why water's density increases below the freezing point and becomes less above freezing. Any substance contracts when it's cooled, but water does the opposite. It expands. People learn to exploit this unique property in the distant past. Inhabitants of the far north would quarry stone by pouring water into cliff-faced crevices before the frosts came. In the south, people pounded wooden wedges into cracks in the rock and then doused them with water. As they swelled, the wedges would break the stone. Much later, scientists established that water in pores and capillaries is capable of creating enormous levels of pressure. In a seed, for example, it reaches 400 atmospheres at the moment of germination. That's why a plant shoot can break through asphalt with ease.
It's such a small molecule as well. It is very specific that these properties are of water. And you won't find other molecules that have all of the similar anomalies.
If even a single one of these anomalies were missing, life itself would not exist on the planet. Every one of water's properties is unique, and they do not easily fit into the generally accepted laws of physics. Science has not yet been able to answer the question of why water is the only substance on the planet that can exist in three states: liquid, solid, and gaseous. Why does water have the highest surface tension of all liquids? Why is it the most powerful solvent on Earth? And how, in defiance of the Earth's gravity, is water able to rise through the trunks of gigantic trees against tens of atmospheres of pressure?
We
have taken a great step forward. We have really understood that we know almost nothing about water. Therefore, it is a great step because this realization is followed by the desire to find something out. Southeast Asia, the year is 1956. The place is a secret military laboratory for developing and producing weapons of mass destruction. Work has been underway here for several years on a powerful new generation of bacteriological weapons. The scientists are discussing what properties this weapon should have at one of their protracted secret meetings. Suddenly, the session breaks off. All of the participants are taken to the hospital with symptoms of severe food poisoning. An investigation into what happened quickly hits a dead end. The scientists had consumed nothing except water from the carafes on their tables. The water was tested. No harmful additives were found. Its chemical composition was H2O. That's what the report said. Poisoning caused by ordinary water. 20 years later, a fantastic hypothesis was put forward, a hypothesis that could explain water's unpredictable behavior. Water has memory. Experiments done in many countries around the world have shown that water receives and makes an imprint of any outside influence, remembering everything that occurs in the space that surrounds it. Any substance coming into contact with water leaves a trace in the water. Had our ancestors guessed this when they used silver vessels to turn ordinary water into healing water?
It is today the best antibiotic that is made as good in Afghanistan and Iraq The American army uses this water, one atom per 100 million, to kill all the germs in a wound. So the President of the United States uses this water to keep infectious bugs from his hand. So I said, how can this water be?
As it records information, water acquires new properties, yet its chemical composition remains unchanged.
So their theory was the chemical composition of the water is important. Now the sensational news is that that is nonsense. The structure of water is much more important than the chemical composition.
The structure of water means how its molecules are organized. We can see how water molecules join together into groups. These are called clusters. Scientists came up with the idea that these clusters work as memory cells of a certain sort, in which water recalls the whole history of its relationship with the world as if on magnetic tape.
People don't think, when you turn on the light, the water is changing. When you turn on the electric field, from the power lines, the water may change. So that is the direction of research.
Water, of course, remains water, but its structure, like a nervous system, reacts to any irritation. Modern instruments have made it possible to record the fact that within each of water's memory cells, there are 440,000 information panels, each of which is responsible for its own type of interaction with the environment.
If you consider a cluster as a group of specific molecules, then it can survive only a short amount of time. But if you consider it as a structure whereby molecules can leave and other molecules come in, the cluster can last effectively for a very long time.
The stability of the cluster structures confirmed the hypothesis that water is capable of recording and storing information.
It may be the single most malleable computer, which can, it's like a computer memory. It's the memory of information. We must know how it is arranged. It is like the alphabet. If I give you the alphabet, you don't know a word, you don't know a letter, you don't know a sentence. So the molecular structure is the alphabet of water. And you must make a sentence out of water, and you can change a sentence.
Okay, so that was that. Part of that was actually, they had included that in one of the clips that I played last night. So there were some new parts in there, and then whoever had put one of those clips that I had in the podcast last night had clipped part of this out and then, you know, and mixed it with some other stuff. So nonetheless, very interesting. It's very interesting. You think about it. Everything else, when you freeze it, it contracts, but water expands. And, and then, of course, our bodies are 70% water. Without water, we wouldn't exist. So it's a very interesting thing, and it seems so simple and so familiar, but yet there's still a great mystery to it, isn't there? So anyway, I think I'm going to go ahead and cut this off. Hope everyone has had a great weekend. Hope you have a great week coming up, and I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com. Thank you.
Thank you.